Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Smith v. Wilson. Ms. Kurtz?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Dana L. Kurtz appearing on behalf of appellants Anthony Smith and Flying AJ's Towing Company, LLC. Plaintiffs are requesting that the Court reverse the judgment of the District Court and remand the case for a new trial, or in the alternative, remand the case with directions for the Court to consider injunctive relief and attorney's fees and costs. In this case, the Chief of Police of the town of Beloit relied on unsubstantiated rumors based on racial stereotypes to keep plaintiffs off of the towing list, and the racial stereotypes that plaintiff was a drug dealer.
So, Ms. Kurtz, let's maybe cut to the chase, because you do have a favorable jury finding on the first question, whether race was a motivating factor. But then in the second question, the jury finds that Chief Wilson would have come to the same conclusion anyway. And I have looked all through the jury instructions, and it seems to me, taken as a whole, you can correct me if I'm wrong or point me to something, but it looks like the trial court did tell the jury that the burden was on Wilson to establish what I'll call the Mount Healthy affirmative defense, that he would have, in fact, taken this action anyway. And if that's true, despite the very distasteful nature of his behavior, I'm not sure what we can do here.
Your Honor, you are correct that the jury instructions put the burden on the defendants. However, the special interrogatory did not. The point of what this court can do is look at...
What do you mean? Could you explain what you mean by that? Because the jury instructions, you know, tell the jury what to do. So what do you mean the special interrogatory didn't?
The special interrogatory does not specify whose burden it is in the second question.
I was just going to say, if the court has told them where the burden lies, isn't that enough?
Yes. And the evidence in this case, the point of this appeal and what this court can do is looking at the defendant's burden, which the defendants do have the burden. And this court in Rand versus CF Industries in 1994 said that rumors are not enough for a party to meet its burden. Inferences and opinions must be grounded on more than flights of fancy, speculation, hunches, intuitions, or rumors.
But the point is, you're asking us to go behind the jury's finding here, and there are a number of ways the jury could have reached that decision. It could have reached that decision because of maybe information, but it could have reached the decision, as your opponents argue, simply because inertia was easier than doing anything else. There were certain companies on the list at the time he became chief. And actually, that raises a second question that I had for you. You say a couple of times in your brief that Ace Towing was taken off the list and then put back on. And I couldn't find that in the record. So if you could show where in the record that fact comes out, that would be very helpful.
In 2004, Chief Wilson removed Ace Towing. It's at docket 267, which is the 4/26/11 a.m. trial transcript at page 53. Also at docket 267, trial transcript, page 159, and docket 269, which is the p.m. transcript from the trial at page 23.
And what do those places say? They say Ace was taken off and then put back on?
In 2004, Chief Wilson removed Ace Towing. In 2005, Ace Towing was then put back on the list despite prior complaints, which is at docket 267, page 132 of the trial transcript.
Who was testifying?
4/26/11. I wasn't the trial counsel.
I can't remember who
was testifying.
We can look that
In addition
up.
To Ace Towing, the court can look at the record with CNC, which Wilson admitted that he had received their application March 9th of 2010. Attached in our supplemental appendix to the reply is the letter from December of 2009 that there were only two towing companies on the list, and Wilson admitted at docket number 267 at page 35 and 36 that in 2009, a full year prior to receiving CNC's application, he had received Smith's application to be included on the towing list. There is substantial evidence in this case that the defendants did not meet their burden of proof.
Well, we know that the jury easily could have come out the other way on that question. The question is whether the jury had to reach a verdict in your favor, right?
Based on the evidence, yes.
Why isn't it reasonable for a jury to say in this situation the chief had plenty of other problems, he didn't care very much? This was a fly speck on his radar screen.
That is not what the evidence showed at trial, in addition to the fact that all of the evidence about these rumors of drug dealing that the district court allowed in substantially prejudiced the plaintiffs at trial.
Let's take those one at a time.
Sure.
Okay. On the question, didn't Wilson testify, in essence, I didn't care, I was busy with other things?
He testified he didn't change the list. And even if the court takes that into consideration, that there were three on the list at the time, you have all of this undisputed evidence in 2004, 2005, 2008, 2009, that there were not three towing companies on the list and that they applied for, that they had.
Let me ask you, what's unreasonable about a jury saying, in essence, squeaky wheels will get the grease. This wasn't a problem for the chief. Maybe he was a racist. Maybe this is, well, he was a racist. We've got strong evidence and strong verdict on that point. But this wasn't something that he cared very much about. Why is that an unreasonable verdict?
In light of the evidence and all of the admissions at trial, and in light of the prejudice to the plaintiff that the court admitted all of these rumors.
Okay. The rumors are a separate question, at least in my mind. But I wanted to ask you about those because I thought that those came out in the plaintiff's examination of Chief Wilson.
In terms of the rumors that came out at trial, the plaintiff had actually objected. Plaintiff objected to the rumors. Chief Wilson claimed for the first time after the lawsuit was filed in his deposition that he denied plaintiff's inclusion on the towing list because of the rumors. And then plaintiff's counsel did object at trial. The court...
Where do we see that trial? Because I'm looking at the examination of Wilson, and it's all coming out in the direct by plaintiffs.
Right,
without
and the,
objection.
The district court... The district court at docket 265, which is the 425 2011 PM transcript at page 161 and 162, on objections of counsel, the district court said that it was not appropriate, that it may not be appropriate for defendants to present evidence of rumors that Plaintiff Smith was a drug dealer without any concrete form beyond vague rumors. And
okay.
Then...
Let me get back to my question. This evidence looks like it came in through plaintiff's questioning without objection.
I believe that the plaintiff's counsel did object to the rumors.
The answers to her own questions?
In light of the court indicating that it wouldn't be admissible, I believe she did make an objection, and the court indicated that he
would... Could you direct me to that?
Yes. I have at page 161 and 162 of docket 265 are the objections and the court's ruling on those rumors and saying that he would reserve that for the end of the trial.
Okay, but I'm looking at the examination of Wilson.
Yes.
When they come into evidence.
Yes.
Apparently without objection. That seems to me like a problem if you're trying to rely upon that as a basis for a new trial.
I believe, based upon the review of the transcript, that the trial counsel, in light of the court saying that she would, that the court would look at that at the end of the trial, was preserving the issue of the rumor that
by offering them herself.
Well, the court had already indicated that it was going to come in, and he would consider that based at the end of the trial once all the evidence was in. The court also admonished that these evidence of rumors that the defendants had to establish by concrete evidence, which they never did through the course of the trial. In fact, the defendants admit in their response brief that these were rumors.
But I have a different issue about the rumors, and that's this. It's pretty well established that in all kinds of discrimination cases, that there's a difference between use of evidence that came to the decision maker, whether the reports were right or wrong. If that's what the decision maker thought, that's what the decision maker was acting on. And things that are just rank stereotypes. You know, if Chief Wilson had said, you know, I think all African-American owners are lazy and unreliable or something like that, that would look like a stereotype. These rumors were about specific activity, about drug dealing, about overcharging. And so if that's what people had told him about it, whether it was right or wrong, true or false, why is it a problem for him to rely on it?
There are several reasons it's a problem for him to rely on it. One, he admitted that he only relied on these rumors with respect to the plaintiff and no one else.
But why does he have to do anything else? I mean, where is the legal obligation on him to run these things down and find out whether it's right or wrong?
Well, under the Equal Protection Clause, there's evidence that he heard rumors about others and didn't exclude them from the towing list. So even if he could rely on rumors, which based upon the defendant's burden of proof to prove that race was not a reason, he would not be allowed to rely on rumors. As this court has repeatedly held, plaintiffs in their burden of proof aren't allowed to rely on rumors. But there's evidence.
But again, I mean, I guess I'm not sure that you're getting my point, because let's just suppose it was overcharging. And I know that you say other people did too, but for right now, let's suppose he hears that this particular company overcharges, and he says, well, I don't want to put people on this list if I'm just going to get a bunch of citizen complaints about overcharging, so they're off. Well, that's a racially non-discriminatory reason. It may be that somewhere deep in his soul, you know, there was a racial reason as well, but on its face, it's non-discriminatory.
That would be non-discriminatory. However, in this case, Chief Wilson admitted that he received complaints about others and didn't rely upon those rumors.
I understand the point about differential treatment of the same information, but that's not because it's a rumor. That's because it's differential treatment.
Right. And he also admitted that the town didn't have any complaints against the plaintiffs. So to allow a party, any party, whether it's the plaintiff or the defendant, to rely on rumors to meet their burden of proof goes against numerous cases before this court where the courts have held that rumors are not enough. This is distinct from a Title VII case where the courts talk about the burden shifting under McDonnell Douglas, where it's just a burden of articulation. Here, the defendants actually have the burden of proof and did not meet that burden. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. Kurtz, I'm sorry. I'd like to ask you one other question that really gets to the combination of constitutional and statutory claims that makes the affirmative defense here, the mixed motive question, so tricky. It has to do with question 4 on the verdict form, which asks, did Wilson violate the plaintiff's right to equal protection under the 14th Amendment by treating Flying AJs differently than similarly situated white businesses? The equal protection claim would seem to me custom tailored for a Mount Healthy Arlington Heights mixed motive defense or approach, but it wasn't included there, and the jury just said no. Given the rejection of the equal protection claim, how does that affect other theories that you have?
If you look at the jury instructions on the equal protection claim, the court uses the similarly situated. And there were no other, at that time, there were no other black towing companies. I think that's based upon that actual specific jury instruction on the equal protection claim, which is distinct from the jury instruction on the Title VII and 1981 claims.
Title VI, you mean?
I'm sorry, Title VI, yes.
What, but was it based on any different conduct?
The jury instruction for the equal protection claim was substantially different. Then
why?
Why? I wasn't the trial counsel. I don't know why the parties proposed that instruction of offering similarly situated. It was vastly different from even the Seventh Circuit's pattern instruction on equal protection and race claims. And going to Your Honor's point about the mixed motive, the motivating factor is very different from mixed motive. And in this case, the defendants asked for the mixed motive. which is that even if we had proved a motivating factor at trial, then at least under Title VII, and the parties conceded that under Title VI, plaintiff would be entitled to injunctive relief and attorney's fees and costs. But after the trial, in light of the case law under Gross, the court held that that was not allowed. And I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gertz. Mr. Howie?
May it please the Court. I am Scott Howie. I represent Defendant Appellee John Wilson, the former Chief of Police of the town of Beloit. This Court should affirm the jury verdict from the District Court because the defendants satisfied their burden of proof of proving that race was not a but-for cause of the plaintiff's exclusion from the tow list.
Well, let's get away from that at least for the constitutional claims, because I, in my own mind, would distinguish Title VI and 1981 from the constitutional claims. The Supreme Court had said, not just in Mount Healthy, not just in Arlington Heights, also in Hunter against Underwood, that when we have a constitutional claim, we have a motivating factor and a shift actually in burden of proof. So I'm interested in what appears to me to be ambiguity in the statements that the district court is giving to the jury about who really has to carry that burden to show that no matter what, racism or anything else, Chief Wilson was just not going to fool around with the list of people who could tow.
That's correct, Your Honor. The situation that we have here, I think,
gets very mixed up. By the time we have question one, question two, and question four, there are standards flying all over the place. There's a lack of clarity. And I think we can all certainly state the law in the abstract without any trouble. But when you apply it to this record, it becomes much more difficult.
Well, let me try and to straighten it out. First of all, I believe the plaintiff's counsel has conceded this morning that it is enough if the instructions supply the jury with the proper burden of proof, even if it's not contained specifically in the special interrogatories that were given. Your Honor suggested that during her argument, and I believe Ms. Kurtz agrees that the instructions were adequate to supply the proper burden of proof to the jury.
What if the instructions were contradictory, though? It seems to me there are places where one could see the judge just saying the burden of proof is on the plaintiff, period, and then other places where maybe he's focusing in a little bit more on this. I don't know. But, you know, if you're a lay juror sitting there, are you getting a mixed message?
Well, that's why it's important to look at the instructions as a whole, and the cases are legion, that talk about looking at the instructions as a whole body of instruction, telling the jury as a whole what to do, rather than focusing in on one particular instruction that in isolation might be thought to be misleading.
Well, surely you're not suggesting, for example, that the jury on question four should have figured out that they should have gone through a burden-shifting analysis?
Not strictly from the special interrogatory. But again, that would be focusing solely on the interrogatory and not on the instructions as a whole.
So you think the jury was instructed on a burden shifting for the equal protection claim? Is that your contention?
I believe that is to be found in the instructions. More importantly, though,
Where?
The equal protection claim does not appear to be part of the plaintiff's appeal in this case.
That's your much better.
They have focused. Equal protection is
really
outside.
Let me ask you, if I could, Mr. Howie. At page 26 of your brief, you said that the plaintiffs failed to come up with anything like a smoking gun. Frankly, I've never seen a transcript that had more smoking guns in a discrimination case.
Well,
what did you mean by that?
If there is any smoking gun in this case, Your Honor, it's a gun that's pointed in the wrong direction.
No, this is an amazing case in terms of the record. The amount of evidence from Chief Wilson himself, I'm never going to let these blankety-blank, people have a towing contract. I mean, it's a stunning transfer.
And there is no dispute. He admitted it. He's the decision-maker. This has got smoking guns all over it.
And there is no dispute.
If I could get to a different question, Mr. Howie. We've got here, I think, a much broader question beyond the Beloit Police Department, okay, in terms of the remedies that are available in light of the jury's verdict on question one. We've got the jury finding that racism was infecting decisions at the highest level of the police department. Under those circumstances, why shouldn't a district court have discretion, at least discretion, to consider whether to grant injunctive relief for the future for the benefit of the plaintiff and others who are similarly situated?
Because the jury didn't find that it made a difference. And under federal law, all suits of federal law require a showing of but-for causation. This jury found that that burden wasn't satisfied. The allowance of remedies for something less than but-for causation is available in statutes that provide for that.
Well,
and Title VII is a notable exception.
Let's suppose you've got a somewhat differently structured case where the plaintiffs come in on a broader challenge to police practices and show that racism is infecting the entire department without necessarily showing specific wrongdoing, specific promotion decisions, hiring decisions, other sorts of policy decisions, that without showing but-for causation, but they show that racism is infecting the department. Is it your belief that the district court cannot provide injunctive relief?
If the racism affects the department in a way that gives rise to a Title VII claim, then Title VII provides the ability for a jury to find liability on the basis of motivating factors.
How about the 14th Amendment?
14th Amendment would be a constitutional claim, clearly. That would be something that would require the burden shifting. And that
to
might
get damages, that's right.
Yes.
I'm talking about a need for an argument that injunctive relief is needed going forward to protect the plaintiff's ability to participate in the life of his community, to conduct his business the way he ought to be able to conduct it, and to, in essence, clean up the police department's approach to race.
There would still need to be some sort of concrete showing of what those effects were.
Hamilton's talking about a pattern or practice case where there's just an across-the-board effect on everything.
And you've got a threat of future harm.
In that case, if a plaintiff could show a let's say, an equal protection claim or a 14th Amendment claim, those would be situations obviously different from this case in which a plaintiff might be able to prevail, might be able to obtain the sort of injunctive or declaratory relief that Title VII makes available under its specific language for situations where a plaintiff can show motivating factor. But for those statutory claims, Title VII is the notable exception. It's the exception that proves the rule.
We're not, frankly, that interested in the statutory claims at this point. At least I'm not. I'm more interested in the 14th Amendment claim.
A 14th Amendment would be different from this case. The plaintiffs make no 14th Amendment claim. Had they made such a claim, that might be analyzed somewhat differently.
What do you mean they didn't make a 14th? They had an equal protection theory. That's the 14th Amendment,
which is no longer at issue in this appeal.
Question four, and I guess in general I understand them to be saying in this appeal that the instructions to the jury were confusing, that the jury wasn't properly told about the burden-shifting approach that applies to constitutional claims. There's a fair amount of discussion of that in both of your briefs.
But the plaintiff's counsel concedes that the instructions were sufficient in her argument
morning. Maybe for number two. I'm not sure that this was an across-the-board concession.
As to the issues before the court in this case, however, we are looking at a statutory regime, certainly as to Title VI, which does not contain any relaxed alternative burden of proof the way that Title VII does.
Now, what about your position at trial about Title VI? Wasn't there some concession that the same standard applied as applies to Title VII?
I believe that the stipulation the plaintiff's counsel is referring to is the stipulation that all three claims, Title VI, Section 1981, and Section 1983, were all governed by the same standard. Title VI contains another requirement for the acceptance
right,
of federal
of
assistance,
funds,
which is beside
we know
the point.
That, that's easy.
But so apart from that, the statutes are to be examined in the same way. That way, however, is not the way that the plaintiff interprets it.
But they are. Well, you know, 1981 is his right to contract on equal terms with white people, as I think is the way it's phrased. You know, Title VI, as you say, is the recipient of federal funds. I'm just wondering to what extent on either side all of this has been preserved. Judge Conley is clearly very distressed about this case. I mean, the jury's initial finding and the evidence in this case is appalling to come across in 2012.
And there is no dispute that Chief Wilson said offensive things about African Americans. That is not what's in dispute in this case. It's admitted that many of those things were stated. What's at issue here is whether that made a difference. And the jury concluded that it didn't. The jury found that regardless of whether race had been a factor or not, it specifically concluded that in its answer to the special interrogatories, that it didn't make a difference in the end because the plaintiffs would have been excluded from the TOE list anyway, regardless of Mr. Smith's race. That's but-for causation. That's the sort of standard that applies in all suits under federal law, as this Court has repeatedly held since Gross. Gross is the case where the Supreme Court set forth the standard of requiring but-for causation unless a statute provides otherwise.
Well, and, but, you know, as we explained, and in fact, I think you're over-reading Gross because, in fact, Gross itself says that it is not in any way disturbing the Mount Healthy system of proving things with motivating factors and a shift in the burden of proof. Now, we can throw around terms like but-for causation all day, but there are different approaches for, let's say, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, which was at issue in Gross, and a constitutional claim like Mount Healthy was dealing with or like some of the other cases have.
Certainly.
And Gross says that, so there's nothing in Gross that in any way touches the fact that there's a different methodology.
No, but the rule of decision that informed the decision in Gross also applies equally well here, not just with the ADEA as in Gross, but the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, which this court interpreted, which this court interpreted in Sirwatka to require a showing of but-for causation.
Right, I have been focusing on the constitutional claims as Judge Hamilton has, and Gross itself says that the Mount Healthy structure applies to constitutional claims, and that's why I don't want to get diverted off into things that I at least don't think are as much on the table.
Even under that standard, though, Your Honor, this would be a case where the jury would be left with the decision as to whether this is the racism that Chief Wilson showed made a difference in the end. It had to make more of a difference than just being a motivating factor. It had to play a causal role in the but-for sense, just as in other constitutional cases, for example, the decision in the Fairley decision.
Fairley is there, but Fairley is followed by Green, in which we explain, you know, with in greater detail how these things all work together. Then there's Sarita. There are a number of cases in this line, and you can't just pluck a sentence or two out of one of them without the full understanding.
That's true, but the sentences that come from all of them stand for the proposition, as Fairley put it, that Gross did overrule those cases that say that a plaintiff just needs to show that his speech was a motivating factor. in the defendant's
decision.
But
that's not what Gross said. You know, in the context of Fairley, that may be fine, but I think once you look at Green as well to really clarify the scope of what Fairley is talking about, there's the distinction between necessary factors, sufficient factors, something that might be sufficient to show that it's a motivating factor, but it may not be necessary if it turns out the person would have done the same thing anyway. I mean, I do think that this court has refined the approach in these cases, especially, I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to tell the Supreme Court you were wrong and Gross to say that you're not changing Mount Healthy? That would be very unseemly.
If I may take a moment, and certainly I wouldn't suggest that this court do that, but I think this court can apply the Mount Healthy framework to the case at bar and find that there is still something more required than the notion that race played a function in Chief Wilson's decision,
okay.
That it had a greater causal effect than that. And for that reason, I submit that the defense satisfied its burden and that the jury's verdict should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howie. Ms. Kurtz, you had your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute.
She tried to sit down. She tried to sit down.
Thank you, Your Honor. I had one point of clarification. The court had asked about the equal protection instruction, and in fact, we did address that in our brief at page 23. And the court had asked about the instruction, which actually says to establish their claim of a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, plaintiffs must prove by preponderance of the evidence that Wilson purposely treated plaintiffs less favorably than similarly situated white businesses when Wilson denied foreign AJs an opportunity to apply for inclusion. That instruction does not shift the burden to the defendants.
Did the plaintiff object to that instruction?
There was an objection. But not based upon the similarly situated. And I think the court can, under Rule 51, still find that all of those instructions were in error. And the additional error in response to that instruction is that the problem with that is there weren't any whites that actually applied until March of 2010, which makes an additional error in that instruction, not only on the failure to do the burden shifting.
This sounds like you want us to relitigate this case. Frankly, the district judge is entitled to rely a good deal on counsel to frame the issues, right?
That is true. However, this court in its discretion can reverse and remand. But in addition to the fact that rumors were allowed in that substantially prejudiced the plaintiffs, we think that the plaintiffs should have an opportunity to receive a fair trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Howie. The case is taken under advisement.